It is so nice to see all of you, and it has been a huge encouragement to speak to many of you already and just to hear some of what you're doing. I very much hope that I will have a chance to chat to many more of you before the end of the day. I noticed that I've been put down on the timetable as a paper, and lots of people have been asking me about it, which paper is much too grand a title for what I'm hoping to do. It's more the sort of random musings I had about ministry over the summer that I'd love to share with you. What I want to do is to think about how we cope with the frustrations and apparent failure of so much of our Bible teaching. We know that's the case, don't we? We know that God does grow his word, his kingdom through his word as it's taught. We teach our heart out, and we seem to see so little fruit. Unless I haven't spoken to the right person, no one here has told me that vast numbers are being converted in their churches, that they have more than enough leaders in their churches for all the roles they'd love to fill, that their partners are abounding everywhere. And I think we all have that slight sense of frustration. Why is it it doesn't seem to be working more than it is? The bad news is, and I think I can say this as the person who's been in Bible teaching ministry for longer than anyone else in the room, I think I got there a year before William, that it gets worse the longer you go on. When you start off, you may not expect much fruit. You think, I'm just starting. When you've been doing it for 10, 20, 30 years, you think, why is there not more fruit? I think that's what the reason why so many evangelicals over the years have drifted away from Bible teaching in search of something that will produce more fruit from their ministries. Now, I'm sure none of us will do that. As I said, I've been so encouraged speaking to us over the last 24 hours or so, just how much people are committed to sticking to the word and teaching the word. So I won't spend any more time on leaving the Bible behind, because that's not going to be our danger at all. What might be more our danger is we teach the word just slightly less and prioritize other things slightly more. That's a really, really easy thing to do, because in ministry, there are so many other things that are really important, and we absolutely have to do them. They are good things. Working with people, training leaders, running small groups, planting churches, growing people for full-time Bible teaching ministry. Those are really important and really essential things. But because the Bible teaching doesn't seem to produce quite as much fruit as we'd like, we begin to focus more on those other things, hoping that they will produce the fruit that we long for. I really want to be clear, those other things are good. I'm absolutely not saying we should stop them. I included things like training leaders, training people for full-time ministry, running small groups, because all of you know how passionate I am about those. I'm really talking about very, very good things, but they can still squeeze out, just ever so slightly, focusing on the Bible. They take on a life of their own, and we stop thinking the word is the way through which God grows his church. I suspect we have all read the book Trellis and Vine. I hope we have. If we haven't, we really ought to. It's a very, very good book. But I wonder whether we need to think just a little bit more, what exactly is the vine? I think we know this concept of trellis and vine very well, and then we're slightly sloppy about what we mean by the vine and what is the trellis. If Jesus says that the kingdom grows through the word being taught, if Jesus says, as he does to Martha, that the one needful thing is hearing his voice, then the vine is teaching the word, hearing the word. Everything else is trellis. You grow leaders, you plant churches, you send people into full-time ministry, you run groups. Everything is in order that the word is taught. There are means to the end, that the end is teaching the word. But I think in the frustration of actual Bible teaching ministry, we can lose sight of that. Now, I'd love to say a lot more about that, but I want to move on to something which I think is an even more subtle danger that we can fall into in when we face the frustrations of Bible teaching ministry. I think it's one that we all do succumb to. I certainly do. I've seen it in myself. These are musings I had over the summer, and I felt very challenged by them as I realized the extent to which I myself have fallen into this particular trap, and I think all of us do. And that is, we very slightly alter the word of God in a hope that it will produce the fruit that we long for. We don't do it intentionally. It is totally inadvertent. It is very subtle. It is not major. We just feel that God needs a little bit of a helping hand. The word needs to be just tarted up a little bit to produce the fruit that we don't seem to be seeing in our ministry. When we look back in church history, we see many Christians who have done that very crassly. And when we see them do it crassly, it is obvious what they have done. So when the Enlightenment Christians took the miracles out of the Bible in an attempt to reach the rationalists of their age, that is exactly what they were doing, weren't they? They wanted fruit. They wanted their evangelism to work in a rationalistic age. So they took the miracles out. And we scoff at them, and we despise them for what they have done there. We would never do anything as obvious and as crass as that. But I do wonder whether we occasionally, much, much, much more subtly, begin to tiptoe down the same sort of line of trying to give God a helping hand. Now, you may not agree entirely with what I'm about to say. What I'm about to say in the specifics may not apply to you. But I think I'd encourage all of us to think, are we actually teaching the Word of God as God wrote it? Or are we slightly changing it in an attempt to produce more fruit? So if you don't agree with my analysis, are you doing it in a slightly different way? The concern that I've had that I think I'm seeing more and more about, more and more of, is that I think the Bible is a book about God and what he is doing, and we are changing it just ever so slightly into a book about how we respond to that. And the reason we do that, obviously, is because the response is the fruit we want. We want to see the changes in the people. We want the people to become Christians. We want to see the growth. So that's where we focus, rather than leaving the focus on God and what he is doing, because that doesn't seem to quite produce the fruit we long for. I think we can do it in our teaching explicitly. We can do it when we send people away to think about it individually or informally. We can do it as we encourage people in Bible study groups to apply the sermons and think about what implications it has for them. But we just begin to shift the focus away from God and what he's doing to us and our response. Now, I've shared some of these musings over the last few months with staff at St. Helens, and several of times I've been misunderstood, and this is one of the places I've been misunderstood. So there will be several caveats in what I'm saying. It is really, really important to say that response to what God is doing is in the Bible. I'm not saying it's one, not the other. They are both there. The question is, where's the emphasis? And I think the emphasis in the Bible is on God and what he's doing. And the emphasis in our teaching is very often how we respond to that. And I think we may need to change that. When I say God, I mean all three persons of the Trinity. Sometimes the Father, sometimes the Son, sometimes the Spirit, very often in the Old Testament, an undifferentiated God. And when I say what he's doing, I mean everything he's doing. Creating, revealing, rescuing, judging, the whole works. So I'm not trying to be too narrow when I say God and what he's doing is what the Bible is about. Let me give us three arguments for why I think that is the case. Why the Bible really does place more emphasis on God and what he's doing. First of all, the Bible as a whole is an account of God and his rescue plan. It is an account of God creating a universe. It's an account of God judging sin when humans sinned against him. It's an account of God electing and choosing Abraham and his descendants. It's an account of God making promises to Abraham, of God rescuing Abraham's descendants, of God judging Abraham's descendants when they sin, of God rescuing Israel when she sins, of God making covenants with Israel, first to Moses, then through David, making promises through the prophets, sending his own son to come to earth to die for sin, of God coming to bring about a new creation. If you think about the Bible as a whole, the whole thing is clearly, I think, a story of God and what he is doing. It would be very odd, wouldn't it, if the whole thing is a story of God and what he's doing, but every single little bit of it is about how we respond to that. That just doesn't make sense. If the whole thing is about God and what he's doing, it is highly likely that the majority, at least, of the individual bits are also about God and what he's doing. So I think I want to suggest that if our teaching, whether it's preaching or Bible studies or one-to-ones or anywhere else, over a period of time isn't placing the emphasis on God and what he is doing, our teaching may not be entirely biblical. Now, again, hear me correctly. I'm not saying that is the case for every single talk, every single Bible study. Clearly, there are some passages which do focus more on our response. But over a period of time, over the weeks and months and years, if the bulk, the vast bulk, I'd say, of our teaching is not focused on God and what he is doing, is it really biblical? Second argument. The gospel is about God and what he's doing. We all know that, don't we? In every single evangelistic talk or one-to-one we ever do, I hope we say something along the lines of, Christianity is not about what we do for God. It is about what God has done for us. That's what we say, isn't it? Wouldn't it be so odd if the Bible, which is the account of that gospel, was then all about what we do for God? It just doesn't seem to make sense. So I think that if we're not preaching, teaching week on week more about what God has done for us and what God has done full stop, is our teaching actually Christian? Many of us will know that there's quite a big debate at the present moment about whether you need to put Jesus into every sermon if it's going to be a Christian sermon. I don't see how that can be right, because surely it must be Christian to be able to preach, teach about God the Father or the Spirit or about man and his sinfulness. But I do wonder whether if over a period of time, if our teaching isn't focused on God and what he's doing, whether we can say it's Christian teaching. So that's a thought for us to mull on. We can see that happening in other parts of the church, can't we? The Roman Catholic Church, for example, has just drifted away, placing more and more emphasis on us and what we do. And when we see it done so obviously, we can see it's wrong. The danger is we begin to take steps down that path ourselves. Third bit of evidence, if you think about the individual books of the Bible, I want to suggest the majority of those too are about God and what he is doing. Now, I can only sketch my thinking here, because to do a thorough job, you'd have to look at every book of the Bible, and there just obviously isn't time for that now. But I think as you think about the books of the Bible, so many of them don't have an obvious response that they demand. That is certainly true of a lot of the Old Testament books. Think of the historical books. There's no obvious response being demanded. Even in some of the New Testament books, a book like Mark's Gospel that we all teach, so familiar, there's no obvious response. Books like Ephesians even, we infer responses, and we then make quite a lot of that inferred response. Are we right to do so? Even in books where there is an explicit response, it doesn't get as much airtime as we would like it to. So take Luke's Gospel, Luke, Acts, the two biggest books in the New Testament, there is one verse on the response that Luke wants from Theophilus. Famous verse, we all know it, chapter 1, verse 4. These things, I write in these things that you may be certain about what you've heard. And that's the only time he refers to it. We would not do that. That would turn up in every single paragraph that we wrote. Why is it that the Bible writers don't seem to focus nearly as much as we'd like to on response? And even when they do focus on response, it's often to a people who are not us. So that's true, obviously, of the whole Old Testament. That in the Old Testament, even when there is a response, and you think, well, it's obvious what the writer wants Israel to do. We are not Old Testament Israel. We're in a different place in salvation history. Even in the New Testament, sometimes, at least, the audience are different people. Apostles before the cross, church leaders. And yes, we make deductions about that for ourselves, but we always have to be careful we're doing it legitimately. And I think the question is, are we right to do that? Should we be placing more emphasis on what those books are teaching us about God and what he's doing? Here again is a place where I've been misheard, and I think it's really important, so I want to correct it. The authors are not doing this academically. They're not saying, let me give you information about God to fill your brains, fill your notebooks. They really, really do want a response. As much as we want a response, they want a response. The difference is they want the response, but not by going straight for the response. They want us to do things like see God and have our hearts thrilled by him, rather than talking about us being thrilled. They want us to see God and think, I can trust that God, rather than talking about trusting that God. They want to talk about God and elicit a response that way from us. So in other words, in most Bible books, I think it is much more faithful to the author's purpose to focus on what he's telling us about God and what he's doing, rather than on the response itself. And if we do that well, as he's done it well, the response will follow, but we don't need to focus on that. Some epistles may be apparent exceptions to that, but I think, again, fewer than we think. Many of the epistles don't have an obvious application, as I talked about Ephesians already. Many of the ones that do have obvious applications, like Hebrews, have massive chunks of theology as he tries to persuade us, not simply don't give up on Jesus, but here's why you shouldn't. Look at how superior Jesus is in every single way. And that argument about Jesus is, I think, what I'm saying we need to do. It's not that we stop doing the response. We have to keep doing that. It's just where the emphasis is. And the Bible's emphasis is on God and what he's doing, not so much on how we should respond to that. Let me summarize where I've got to so far. Whether we think about the Bible as a whole, the gospel, or the individual books of the Bible, the emphasis of the Bible is on God and what he is doing, not so much on our response. And if that's the case for the whole Bible, the whole gospel, and the whole of books, it is very, very, very likely that that's true of most of the passages we'll teach, and that's therefore the way we should teach them. We should be teaching passages thinking, what is this teaching me about, or us about God and what he's doing, to elicit a response from that. Why would God do that? Why would God place so much emphasis on telling us about himself rather than the response? We, as I said, instinctively think the way to produce a response is by talking about the response. God wants that response even more than we do. God's desire is that every man is saved. God's desire is that we're all conformed to the likeness of Christ. So why does he spend so much time telling us about himself rather than telling us about how we should respond to that? And the reason, I think, is because the key to people changing, the key to the response, is motivation. Most Christians don't do things, not because they don't know what they're supposed to do, but because they're not motivated to do it. No one does, you just be realistic about this, no one does anything in life without a motivation. And the bigger you want somebody to do, the bigger the motivation has to be. That is just a fact of life. Human nature, you don't do things without motivation. Big change, big sacrifices need big motivations. The changes God wants, the lifestyle that God wants is radically different from what we'd instinctively want. The motivations need to be huge to achieve them. So the reason that God gives us so much about himself and what he's doing is to motivate us to respond. The more we see him in all his glory, the more we'll love him, the more we'll trust him, the more we'll hope in him, because he is so wonderful. He is so worthy of love. He is so trustworthy. His appearance will be so wonderful. It is when we get that all the behavior changes we long for will come. Let me give you an example from the Bible. Numbers 13 and 14, we all know that incident so well. Israel at Kadesh Barnea on the border of the Promised Land being told to go in. It's not that Israel doesn't know she should go in. Moses is saying to her, go in. Joshua is saying to her, go in. Caleb is saying to her, you idiots, go in. And she says, let's go back to Egypt. Why? It's because she doesn't know her God. And the story is told to us, and we look at them and we think, how stupid, because we see Kadesh Barnea, Numbers 13, 14, in the context of what God has done in Exodus and all the way through Numbers, and we think, you blithering idiots, go in. A God who can wipe the floor with Pharaoh is going to have no problems with the Canaanites. She didn't see that. We are told so much about God so that we will not be like them. We will actually see God, and we will think, yeah, we can do everything because our God is so powerful, so good, so committed to us, etc., etc., etc. We are told about God to motivate us. So let me just recap on that one. The key motivations, the ones that drive everything else, the ones that get repeated time and time again in the New Testament, are faith, hope, and love. But it's faith in God, hope in God, loving God. And we are told so much about God to elicit those responses. The way we grow in that faith, that hope, and that love is not by being told we must have faith, we must have hope, we must have love. It's not even thinking, what would it look like if we had those things? The problem is we don't have those things. We need to see God so that we do have that faith, that hope, that love. I have long said, as many of you will know, that the author's purpose is much more, will much more often be about changing our worldviews rather than changing our actions. I stand by that, but I think over the years I've realized that's not very helpful. I've had so many people say, but how do I teach that? What does it mean in practice? And so I think in practice it may not be that useful a way of thinking about author's purpose. I wonder whether it is much more helpful to think that an author's purpose is very often going to be to tell us something about God and what he's doing so that we will grow, change in our attitude to God. Tell us something about God and what he's doing so we will love God more, so we will trust in God more, so we will hope in God more, so we will rejoice in God more, so we will adore him more, so we will be committed to him more. And all the fruit that we long for of people being converted, growing, being utterly committed, making sacrifices of time and money, will come when they have that love and that hope and that trust in the Almighty Creator God of the universe. To drive home why this matters, think about the opposite. What happens if we don't teach the Bible this way? Well, people still won't do anything without motivation. So if we want change, what we will do, and I think what happens more and more, is we just add in man-made motivations. And again, church history is so instructive. You look back in church history and you can see that happening so much. So what sort of motivations do people add in when they lose the right motivation of look at God? Well, one obvious one is you add in legalism. You make the Bible appear to command those actions much more than it actually does. And we can see that, and we see that in other parts of the church, and we scorn them. I wonder whether we slightly tend to do the same ourselves. Or if we don't do that, we use our personalities. We charm them. We pressurize them. When we see that in other parts of the church, we despise it as heavy shepherding. We would never go to those extremes, never, ever, ever. Are we in danger of beginning to tiptoe down the path to that and begin to use our personalities to change people? Or another motivation we could use if we don't use the Bibles is we could manipulate them. We can talk about how important it is that they give money and they're committed, because think of all the millions going to hell. The Bible doesn't actually use that motivation. That sort of manipulation to try to get us to do something which we won't do otherwise, give our money, give our time, give our lives for the gospel. And we're desperate to get people to do it, so we find a motivation and we say, think of this, the millions going to hell. The Bible doesn't do that. The Bible motivates us by saying, look at God and what he's done. Be changed through that. As I said, we can easily see other parts of the church doing it. So what I'm saying is not a hypothetical danger. I think it's a very real danger. We will not do it as crassly and as obviously as them. We will do it totally inadvertently. We will do it out of the right motives, because why do we want fruit? We want fruit for God's glory. We do it for the right motivations. But we can end up doing the wrong thing. And we often do it implicitly. So even if we don't explicitly give those wrong motivations, we sometimes leave a vacuum and let people fill it for themselves. And because they're not taught, they will fill it with a wrong man-made application. So leaving a vacuum doesn't actually help either. We have to give the motivation, and it has to be the Bible's motivation. Now, again, I've been misheard on this. It's been so helpful having these musings over the summer and sharing them with some of the staff, because I've had various bits of kickback, so it's told me some of the ways I might be misheard, which I need to correct. I'm not at all talking about what motivation Christians should have before they act. Okay, that's another topic altogether I've not even thought about. I'm talking about what motivation we as Bible teachers should be giving other people. So whether they need to have the right motivation before they do anything or not is not on the agenda. But I think I'm saying that we as Bible teachers have a responsibility and an obligation to give people the right motivation, God's motivation, showing people God. So in summary, overall, the Bible both tells us about God to motivate us and tells us what we should do. But the Bible is primarily about God and what he's doing, because motivation is the greater need. And in the light of that, we may need to change the balance of our teaching so it's less focused on how we should respond and more focused on the God who will motivate that response, the God who will thrill us and capture our hearts and capture our imagination. In conclusion, let me just have two small points. The first is, when I say we need to tell people about God, I'm not saying blow the dust off your doctrine notes from college and regurgitate those. Again, there may be a place for doctrine, I'm not engaging with that, but I think what I'm saying here is that the thing that we need is to have hearts that are thrilled by God, hearts that burn within us because of what we've seen about God. Imaginations that are captured by God and what he is doing. And information about God, technical detail about God, does not achieve that. What achieves that is seeing God in action, seeing the God of the Bible as he acts and thinking, wow, a God who can create a world with a word, a God who is prepared to forgive people who have sinned against him as badly as we see people in the Bible sinning, a God who is prepared to send his one and only son to die. What an amazing, incredible God that is. How worthy is he of love? How worthy is he of trust? How worthy is he of hope? I'm not saying we need to read it into the Bible. I'm not definitely not saying we need to teach our doctrine course from college. What I am saying is we need to read the Bible, realizing that a lot of the Bible might be about God and what he is doing more than we think. That's what I've done over the last few months, and realized that actually, yes, it is. Much more of the Bible than we think is about God. It's just we're slightly blinkered. Because we think it should be about response, we read this chunk of the Bible, which is maybe two-thirds about God, one-third about response, and our eyes zoom in on the response bit, and we sort of slightly blank out the bits about God. And I think once you realize that's the possibility, and that's what we might be doing, we ought to start doing the reverse. And start saying, let's focus on those bits that are about God. Maybe slightly less emphasis on the bits about response. As you plan your sermon series and you think, well, this book is, say, half about theology and half about action, most of us instinctively whistle through the theology bits quite quickly and then slow down when we come to the application bit. Why? I think I'm saying, in the light of what the whole Bible is about, what the gospel is about, what the whole book is about, maybe we should do it the other way around. Slow down in the theology on the God bit so we really see the God of the Bible. The second concluding point I have, and I might even finish early, which would be a miracle, sounds initially like bad news. If we do everything right, we will not see lots of fruit fast. So why are we tempted to go away from teaching the Bible as it is? It's because we wanted fruit, isn't it? So going back to the Bible is not going to give us lots of fruit fast. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I think I am saying that this is the right way to do it. This is the Bible way to do it. And Jesus told us that this would be the case. Being a few minutes early allows me to say, let's turn up Mark 4, a passage we know very well, but so crucial. So Mark 4, as we all know, is three parables that Jesus tells at the start of the ministry with the disciples he's just called. Parables are very rare in Mark's gospel. Compared to Matthew and Luke, he has very, very few parables, and they are very important. They are almost always, I think, in fact, they are always agenda setting. So the most obvious one is Mark chapter 12. Jesus goes into Jerusalem. He tells the parable of the tenants in the vineyard, and it sets the agenda for what he's doing as he goes to his death, and the vineyard is taken away from the old tenants and given to the new tenants. The parables in Mark 4 are equally agenda setting. They come just as Jesus has called the 12 to be the foundation and the nucleus of the new church, and Jesus gives us parables there that tell us about his ministry, their ministry, and by inference, our ministry. And we know those parables, and we teach those parables often, particularly the first one. The first one is the parable, all three are parables of the seed, and the seed is teaching the word. The first one is the parable of the sower who sows across many, many soils. The second one is the parable of the farmer who sows the seed and goes to bed and wakes up and goes to bed and wakes up, and months later pops the seed, and a couple of months later still the harvest. And the third parable is about the mustard seed, so tiny that you can barely see it. We know those, we teach those. We always, always, that I've come across, teach it focusing on the positive, which is right, it's there. In the end, it produces a great harvest, 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. In the end, the farmer has the harvest. In the end, the mustard seed turns into the biggest of trees in which the birds come and live. In those parables, Jesus gives more airtime to the other side of the story. The fact that so much of the seed will be wasted. It will fall on the stony path, and the birds will eat it. So much of the seed will seem to bear fruit, which will not last. It will be choked by the weeds, or it will be on shallow soil and have no roots. The farmer gets the harvest in the end, but in the interim, he goes to bed and he wakes up, and he goes to bed and he wakes up, and he goes to bed and he wakes up, and nothing seems to be happening. And the mustard seed is so very, very, very tiny. And I think what Jesus is saying there is, as you do the right ministry, Bible ministry, the ministry he's doing, the ministry he's calling his apostles to do, the ministry he's giving us to do, that is exactly what we will experience. We will experience little fruit. And even the fruit that we see will take a long time coming. The word will seem so puny and so insignificant when we think about the task ahead of us. But in the end, there will be this amazing, incredible harvest. So if we teach the word faithfully and rightly, focusing on God and what he's doing as it does, Jesus is saying it will produce fruit that lasts and multiplies despite the initial appearances. It will produce real fruit, fruit that truly glorifies and pleases God. So I think what I want us to do, what I'm telling myself to do, is not to lose confidence in the word. If it doesn't seem to be producing fruit, don't worry. Jesus said that would happen. Keep going. In the end, there will be a fruit, an amazing fruit.
Anybody got any observations or reflections on how this helps us as we think about the ministry the Lord has given us?
Or challenges and questions, Richard?
Yeah.
Really helpful stuff. Thank you, Michael. I think my observation is that motivation is the thing that's really lacking. And as I look at my own church, I think I find myself frustrated that those who know what they should be doing are generally doing it, but it feels like a duty often. It looks like a duty to them, feels like it to me. I wonder whether people know these days, especially, what the Christian life looks like. So they still need the application spelt out, don't they?
Yeah.
If I'm hearing you rightly, are you saying you think that we should be spending more time in our preaching showing how wonderful God and the gospel is, and that we should see that as part of our application? It's not that we're squeezing our application, but that our application should be largely at the level of loving God. And then, if we've got that right, we just need to spit out some of the lines of application much more quickly to help people join the dots.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I think that's right. I almost wonder whether this distinction between the body of the work and the application, whether that's even a helpful distinction. I'm not sure the Bible ever actually makes it. So we do have to connect with people. It's so important. We don't see this as an academic theological exercise. It's not a lecture. I'm absolutely not saying that. We have to connect. But we're connecting at the level of changing people's heart, of actually thrilling them. So what do we actually want from the people as we teach the Bible? We want their hearts to burn within them, don't we? It's Jesus walking on the road with Emmaus. His disciples didn't come away thinking, I now know what I should do. Their hearts burned within them. Peter, at the day of Pentecost, people responded as their hearts burned, saying, what then should we do? That's what we want. We want people who are so challenged, so convicted, more than that, who are actually so awed and amazed at God that they come to us saying, what should we do? But now, again, it's really important. I'd love to have more questions because, as I said, as I've shared some of my musings, I think there's been a lot of times I've been misheard, probably because I've not said it very clearly. I really do think we do need to tell people what they have to do, as Richard has said. When I'm absolutely not saying we stop doing that. The Bible does have that. It's just where the balance is. We spend most of our time on what we should do. And the Bible just has it as the odd line, because if your motivation is there, if your love for God is there, you don't need a lot of time saying you should do this. You're waiting to be told what you should do. So you just need a hint and off you go.
Often you can do it simply by teaching what the original hearer heard and understood, rather than kind of going straight to the person sitting in the pew in the 21st century. I think the genius of going back to Corinth actually unfolds the implications for the people of the time of the theology that the theologian, the author, is teaching. And I think that can, it becomes less of a kind of, we've started to talk about implication rather than application here. I think that's helpful. I don't know what you think about that, Michael.
No, I think that's definitely a help in the right direction. I would want to go a lot further, but that's definitely a step in the right direction.
Okay, how do you want to go further?
Well, as I said, I think I want to go further, but not even spending much time on the implication, spending much more time on the God and what he's doing himself, so that people come away thinking, our God is just mind-blowing. And then they say, now, so what? I would love it if, I'm sure we all would, if people would come to us after Bible studies, after talks, saying, I was thrilled by that. Now, what should I do? That's what we want, isn't it? Now, if we do that, if people have that attitude, you don't need to spend a lot of time on what should I do. One liner will do it. But producing that attitude of, I love God. My imagination has been captured by what he's doing. I want to buy into this gospel project. What can I do?
That's really very, very helpful. It's very key, and you'll find this is not a very popular message in all sorts of places. Roger Day.
A comment and a question. The comment is, I think the patience point is really helpful. So I'm now in a context where we've just had a giving push. We're concerned there's not enough evangelism going on in the church family, and we've got a church plant in 6 months, so we'll need more people serving. And the pressure those three areas put on us as a preaching team to think, in 6 months we need more evangelists, we need more servants in different areas of church, and we need more givers, means I can see in all of us a kind of impatience to see see the results, to see the changes at ground level in people's lives. I think my question, and I think coming from St. Helens, where there's been decades of deep expository preaching, there've been small groups doing real discipleship, and there's been one-to-one ministry, probably I've ridden a wave of existing maturity Christianly, and so I've seen lots of stuff happening on the ground quite quickly in my time here. I think lots of associates, especially with students, would see that quite quick changes. I think my question is, when you're trying to lead a church in the right things on the ground, at the same time as do the long-term Bible teaching work, how do you handle that balance? Because you can't just pause and say, we're not going to operate as a church family. We're not going to do evangelism. We're not going to run activities. We're not going to give money. We need money to keep things going. Yeah. We need money to keep Bible teaching going. So I guess to both of you, how do you balance that?
That's the real challenge, isn't it? I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I wonder whether there's some things where we just have to bite the bullet and say, well, we need them. But I wonder whether we put a lot of pressure on ourselves unnecessarily by almost working to timetables that God hasn't given us. So something like the money to keep going, yes, you have to do that. The evangelism is so important. I'm absolutely committed to the fact that the one reason God has left us in this world is to reach this world. If it wasn't for that, he'd bring us home to glory right away. But I think we have this timetable we place on ourselves that I'm not sure God does, that it has to happen now. Mm. As opposed to, it would be much, much, much better, surely, if we grew the people in our church, if it took them a year when nothing happened, but then it really took, and they then had a lifetime of evangelizing. Wouldn't it be so much better than if we pressurize them so they evangelize now, but as soon as we go or they leave, they think, whew, I'm so glad I'm away from that preaching. I will never evangelize again in my life.
Yeah, that's great. It's time for us to finish. Charlotte, can we save your question until question time? I just want to say two things. One is, remember how people learn in the scriptures. They learn both from the word of God, and you yourself have seen my life, my teaching. I think that is a key part of our learning. And actually, the way people really learn is seeing it lived out amongst them as they hear the word of God. The other thing is, I think a lot of people leave St. Helens and see the structures we've got at St. Helens and want it now, and they forget that St. Helens has been operating since 1961 like this. And I look at a lot of young church planters who go out from here and burnout, work themselves silly and run their family ragged, if that's what the right phrase. And they do it because they forget that Dick actually just... It grew, I've got all his Christmas letters from 1976 through to 1997. And it's fascinating to see real growth, step by step by step by step by step. And people try to download kind of St. Helens structures as if you've got to have all of that when you arrive with Erica here up at the end of whichever line you're the end of in a church with three old ladies or whatever. It's just not going to happen. So patience, 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 patience. I think Dick's a model of that. You know, he works incredibly hard, even today. You'll see him at his desk, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. But patience, you know, sensible time and, you know, other interests and all that sort of stuff, you know, so...